destruction, blah, 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 thunder, lightning, and...
And first question. I know you've talked about this before, but what's the deal with the top hat and the scarf and everything? I mean, yeah.
I'm just hideously ugly.
I was going to come up with some question to sort of play off of that, and I couldn't figure out how to word it, so...
You didn't want to say that, Dirk, I've seen you in person and you're really ugly, and I appreciate that. But it's just I have the face of a Gorgon, so that's really...
So to keep us all turning to stone.
Yeah. No,
like, I do this for you.
Yeah, I do this for all of your sakes. basically, it was kind of this branding gimmick that I started when we started – actually, when I started doing the Right or Wrong column for Newsarama way back in the day. We were Jim Reddington, who's the letter design guy and one of my best friends in the world, and we've worked together since I started in comics, basically, which has been a very long, like 10 years or so. And we were getting ready to do like the header for the Newsarama for Right or Wrong. And, you know, a lot of times when people do like columns and stuff like that, they put their picture in there. And I'm like, man, you know, I've done that before. And I talk about this in Right or Wrong book, but, you know, I've done that before. I've had my picture in the newspaper and things like that. And, you know, when I've done columns and stuff before, and I don't know, I just was never a huge fan of doing stuff like that. You know, I mean, not to say that I would get like, nowadays I'd get mobbed at a convention by swarms of, you know, people or something, but there's something nice to be said about when you're going into digital to not have your face on everything per se. And Jim just goes, I've got it. Like, what do you mean? He goes, I know what to do. And he pitched me this idea, and I just started laughing so hard because I thought it was so funny, and it's so tongue-in-cheek, and I'm primarily known as a horror writer anyway. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, why should we do it this way, man? I mean, it's hilarious. But and he goes, well, you know, why don't you write mainly horror stuff? I'm like, yeah. He goes, too, and he goes, and what else do you think a Dirk Manning looks like? I'm like, there it is. All right, let's do it. So we did it, and the picture with the top hat and the glasses and stuff like that just immediately kind of became my brand. And like it or not, which I love and I think it's hilarious, I'm married to it, and there it is. There's
so you've come to accept it.
Oh, I came to accept it right away. I think it was really funny. One of the most surreal moments of my life was when, what happens, I'd go to conventions and stuff like that, and people would, like, expect me to be dressed up like that. And I'm like, no, I did it, like, twice. Once for a Halloween signing, and I did it once at the behest of a publisher for a brief signing appearance at the booth. And it was just, like, the worst thing I ever did. It was just, like, I just couldn't stand it. And but that being said, one of the most surreal moments of my life was when I got a giant 6-foot stand-up banner of the Dirk Manning picture, you know. Mm-hmm. And I'm in my living room, and I pull open this big stand-up, and I'm kind of looking at it, and I'm like, this is my life now. I have a 6-foot picture of myself to put behind myself at conventions. But once I got it and once I started using it, it was like so funny. Like Tony Moore, for example, one time I was walking by a convention. He goes, oh, Dirk. He goes, I see you around. I didn't know it was you. Yeah. And it was like one of those things that once I started fully embracing it and using it at conventions and stuff, you know, I mean, you have a button. A lot of times I like wear a little button with that picture on it because normally I'm just at the shows, you know, just wearing like a black suit or something like that. Mm-hmm. I have a little pin and people are like, oh, Dirk, yeah, you know, I know who you are, because otherwise I'd be in conversations with all these people and, you know, people come and go, and we're at like the bar and I'm throwing back Shirley Temples or something. And true story. And all of a sudden someone will say something about, yeah, blah, 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 you want to know Shirley Temple, Dirk? And someone will be like, oh, Dirk, you're Dirk Manning? I didn't recognize you. And they always do like the hand, you know, like the hand motion.
Yeah. It's the eyes and the hand that really kind of sell it. I mean, like the top hat and the scarf give you like the impression, but then it's the weird eyes, the sort of the head tilt and the, you know, it's the hand with the fingers splayed out. That's the selling point. Like that's the,
yeah. And like, oh, I didn't recognize you without the, and then I know people can't see it, but I'm like covering my mouth and then like sticking their hand out, except the fingers splayed. I'm like, yeah, that's me. Yeah. So since I started like wearing like a little button on my suit, like people that wouldn't otherwise recognize me know who I am. And it's helpful, you know, it's like people, you know, like, oh, I want to see the show. And, you know, so that's where that came from. I mean, mainly it's just branding and it's funny. It just it makes me laugh every time I see it.
You're everything, that's why I cling.
Our Skype connection bottomed out about 2 seconds after the end of Dirk's answer, so I had to call him back on his cell, which didn't lead to us losing any of the interview, but it did lead to a drop in audio quality on Dirk's end. With that being said, let's get back to the interview. Okay, so branding, obviously an important tool for writers of or creators, I guess, of all stripe. One of the things you're, I guess, branded as is as a horror writer, which may come into play with a story that was just released this past week or the week before, the Dia de los Muertos. Before we sort of talk about it, I was just kind of curious, would you consider, I don't want to talk about the story specifics because I think it's, I don't want to, you know, give it away, but would you consider that to be horror? Or not. Because I have an idea.
What's your idea?
My idea is that it's not. I would not consider that a horror story.
Yeah, I honestly would. I mean, coyness aside, I would agree.
Okay.
I think it's a very emotionally wrought story, which I think what good horror does anyway.
Yes.
But it's definitely, I wouldn't say it's a horror story by any stretch of the imagination. People may argue it veers potentially into speculative fiction,
yep.
But even that's definitely... you know, up for debate, because it's funny, after the story came out, a couple people got a hold of me, and they're like, so, and they asked me to kind of, like, explain the ending, and I'm like, well, it's exactly what you think. I'm like, but, and I'm like,
yeah.
It's exactly what you think it is.
Yeah.
It poses a certain question, and the answer, the story is called, I'm not going to Spanish, because I'm an idiot, I took French in high school, but Te Vas, Angel Mio, and, I can read a little bit of Spanish and stuff, but not speak it very well. It talks about some questions with love and in life and what matters and what doesn't matter. And yeah, I don't want to give away the total details of the story, but I wouldn't call it a horror story. I mean, there's no monsters and stuff jumping out or anything like that. It's just honestly, it's a love story. Yeah.
Right. And I mean, it deals with a situation which is very horrible. And one of the things I kind of want to talk about for your career is that horror, when people think of horror, they tend to think of sort of like one specific thing. Like, I don't like slasher movies, therefore I don't like horror.
Right.
And this, you know, if you were to consider this a horror story, you know, it's a horror story in that what happened to the main character was very horrific. But it's real world horror. It's
yeah.
The type of horror that everybody can sort of feel. And certainly I felt it very... you know, very strongly. So, you know, is that, but that's not like a horror story like that other people would sort of call a horror story.
Yeah. And a lot of the credit too goes to Riley for his really emotive art. It was just fantastic on that. But I mean, I don't think we're giving too much away by saying it's a story about a mariachi player who is still mourning, losing the love of his life. Someone he loved very much and he lost her. And, that's kind of the start of the story, you know, as he's, just mourning his lost love, and he meets someone which makes him ask himself some really strong questions about the relationship he had and the relationships he may or may not continue to have. And, you know, one of the reasons, you know, I have this discussion with people a lot, one of the reasons that I like horror so much is because there's so much you can do under the umbrella of horror.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can, you know, Nightmare World is an example of that. You can tell... I've told funny stories, scary stories, romantic stories, and it should be told. The only thing that, after horror stories, my second favorite love is a good love story, which, you know, I mean, a lot of people say they like love horror stuff so much and then love, like, a good love story so much. Because, you know, really, they both, good ones play to the human experience in both genres do. Te Vas, Angel Mio, no, I definitely wouldn't, I mean, truthfully, I wouldn't really call it a horror story by the stretch of the imagination. It's a love story. Perhaps a little, potentially could be seen as a little gothic, but again, maybe not. Some other people see the slice of life. I'm not giving away the answer, man. I'm not going to, you know, give away what's going on in that story. I think it's a lot more powerful and personal for people to decide themselves. I know what I intended when I wrote it. But I also wrote it specifically to be a little bit ambiguous.
Well, I liked it because I mean, certainly you want to talk about branding, and you've branded yourself certainly very strongly early on as being a horror writer. So when they think that, they sort of mentally kind of put parameters about the type of story they're going to get from Dirk Manning. And I think this is, and you certainly have written at least started to write other things that sort of fall outside that category. And I think people would look at this and say, oh, well, like it's just a horror story. And you're like, no, I think this would actually be something you could look at and say, look, no, I'm moving away, not away from horror, but I'm moving.
Well, you know, and I can do other stuff besides horror. And it's something that Jim Valentino, who publishes a lot of my work through Shadowline, and I have talked about a lot. People are like, why isn't there Nightmare World Volume 4 yet? And it's because part of it's been I don't want people to think that Nightmare World is the only thing I write and the only thing I will ever write. Mm-hmm. It's my baby. It's one of it's the project I launched my career with. I'm extremely proud of it. But I'm not a one-trick pony, you know. Horror, I love horror. I will always write horror stuff. But I do other things as well, and I do other things besides Nightmare World. And the story in Dia de los Muertos number one, which, like I was saying earlier, I mean, people should still be able to run to their comic shops and grab a copy, which they should.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Is just an example of that. I think the story still bears a strong stamp of my style of writing and how I write and what I write.
Mm-hmm.
But like you said, it's just a different dimension to what I write as well. My goal is whenever someone reads a Dirk Manning story, you know, it's like, wow, that's really good. That's really powerful. That's really emotional. That's, you know, really cool, man. I dug that.
Yeah.
That's what I want. And I think that this story succeeds in doing that.
Yeah, I did read it. I did think it was very powerful. And I thought it was really cool. So, you know.
Well, thanks, man. Yeah, that's the goal.
Yeah. Well, the goal accomplished. Let's talk about
I have to go real quick on this. I have to give big props to not only to Riley, but also to Megan Wilson, who did the colors, and Kelly Tindall, who did the letters. I mean, it was really, everyone really came together on that. And just this story being the last story, you know, the Tavos Angel Mio, being the last story in Dia de los Muertos number one, being kind of the anchor. I mean, my hope is that when people put down that first issue, which is, you know, in the big golden age format,
yes,
with the cool paper stock,
yes,
I love that. So aesthetically pleasing.
Mm-hmm.
As a book guy, that just, I love the stuff like that. But my hope is when people put that book down, they're just like, damn. And if we did, if that worked, then we succeeded. We did our part. So
yeah. And just to go back to sort of how that came to be, did Riley come to you with even an idea, or were you just sort of offered a slot and it's like, hey, here's your one line parameter, go?
Yeah, we were just offered a slot. Riley reached out to 9 of us because he's going to do 3 issues with 3 12-page stories per issue, and I was one of the guys that he asked to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was blown away because I've loved Riley's work for a long time. He's one of those guys like, someday I'll get to work with Riley on something and it'll just be the greatest.
Mm-hmm.
So when I get this email like, hey, you want to do a story in my which is based on the Spanish Day of the Dead, and I'm like, or Mexican Day of the Dead, and I'm like, yes. I mean, literally, I couldn't type yes. I'll be yes. And then, you know, after I did my little dance around the room, you know, I did whatever I do when I work with any artist for the first time, and I'm like, well, what are you interested in drawing? And he told me, and he goes, you know, I really like passionate stories and something really emotional and stuff like that. And I, okay. You know, and I kind of thought about that a little bit, and I really, you know, I'm very familiar with his style anyway. And I wanted to offer something that would really, I think he's a very passionate artist, and when he draws, and he's just very, there's a lot of emotional depth into some of the stuff he draws. I know sometimes people disassociate him with, like, Cowboy Ninja Viking and Proof and things like that, and stuff that's a little more crazy and a little more
hyperbolic.
Action-y. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted to get something that would just seep emotion and just reek of emotion. And I knew that's something that he would be able to pull off wonderfully. And one of the last, one of the books that does that more than any of the best is Jim O'Barr's The Crow.
Mm.
And I knew that's kind of what I wanted to do, is tell that kind of story that, you know, obviously involving Dia de los Muertos, but also just draw a really resonant, emotionally charged, romantic love story that would, again, you know, have this little bit of ambiguity to it and really make, I want a story that resonates with people. And so I sent him the script and I said, you know, I'm going to just think of this. And he emailed me back and he just said, dude, he goes, like, effing, I think he said, effing awesome was like the first email back, and then told me some of the bits he really liked. And again, I did a little happy dance and things like that. And we ironed it out, and there it went. I think it was just a wonderful experience to work with him. I'm genuinely honored to work with him. I'm a huge fan of his work. And so to get to work with Riley on this, and hopefully maybe someday work with him again, is just fantastic. I'm just over the moon about it, how it turned out.
Yeah, it, you know, the whole issue was good. You know, your story was good. It looks amazing. I haven't actually had a chance to read the other two stories, but I'm sure they're, you know, just as good. And yeah, the Golden Age thing was a bit of a surprise. I mean, you can probably find this, you know, if you're not able to get to a comic shop, if your shop sells out, I mean, you can most likely read the story online. I mean, I'm sure it's going to be offered through Comixology or whatever, but if you get a chance, you really should go out and get the actual issue, because it's a little oversized. And, you know, if you, you know, don't worry about how you're going to board it. Don't worry about how you're going to store it. Just get it and then deal with the other stuff later. Cause that's sort of if I hear a gripe about that sort of stuff, it's like, it's not going to fit into my bag and board, or I don't know where I'm supposed to, it won't fit into my box. You're like, dude, just put it on your bookshelf.
I did a signing at a comic. A guy, he said, yeah, I didn't know it was going to be Golden Age. I don't know how I'm going to file them in the back issues. I'm like, well, you'll just have to sell out.
Yeah.
And he kind of laughed, and I kind of laughed. He called me. I went on Tuesday night and signed the books. Mm. He called me Wednesday before, like at 4 o'clock. He's like, I sold out. I'm like, there it is.
Problem solved.
There it is. I said, just sell them, man, because it's good, you know. And word of, and the buzz on the book's been real positive and stuff like that. So yeah, it's absolutely. Honestly, I'll be totally straight with Greg. I'm a guy that doesn't. I'm not a fan of books of different crazy sizes and things like that, you know, because I'm the same way. It's like I just want to be uniform. I want to be the same. That being said, this is one of those, I would argue, rare books that really benefits from the bigger size of the different paper stock. There's other books that don't need to do this. This book, it's just fantastic in the sense. I mean, it just lets the art breathe, and it's just such an aesthetically pleasing book to even hold for a comic fan. It's a little bit bigger and stuff like that, and yeah, it won't bag and board right, but you put it on a bookshelf somewhere, and it's really worthy of it. It's really worthy of this format.
Well, I mean, it's an art showcase. I mean, this is a Riley showcase, and a couple of things. One, they do sell Golden Age bags and boards, so
if you really
want to bag and board it, you know, you have options. Two, you guys are lucky enough to be at a publisher, both Image and I'm assuming Shadowline, as well, that is able to sort of take that chance and be like, okay, you know, if the artist really wants to, you know, put together this package, we can do that. You know.
Yeah, absolutely, and it works. Like I said, I don't necessarily need a. There's plenty of other books that maybe wouldn't warrant this type of slightly more prestige formatting, but man, just what an amazing book. I'm looking at it right now and just like, oh my God, it just works. It just works.
Yeah. So go out and buy a copy.
Yeah, I'll quit drooling on myself now for my own work, you know.
Yeah.
Stop touching myself inappropriately to look at it.
So moving on. I mean, obviously you enjoy writing short stories, short fiction, short comic stories, I think are sort of in your wheelhouse. When you – I'm trying to sort of parse this out into something a little more complicated than how do you write short stories. But when you're given 8 pages, because I mean most of the Nightmare World stuff was like 8 pages and a cover, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
all the Tales
a splash page. But
volume 1 was as well, right.
Right. What's your sort of mental checklist of looking at that and saying, okay, I've got 8 pages. Like, how do you,
I give myself 8 pages because I think, especially when I publish work online, that lets me do like, you know, 2 pages a week, for example, like I run them on Tuesday and Thursday and pace things out nicely. You know, no wasting time, no navel gazing. And most of the Nightmare World stories could easily be a 22-page story if I wanted them to bad enough. Mm-hmm. You know, then there's more story to be told. But what I do with the 8-page format is, and you know, I talk about some right or wrong book a little bit as well. When I was getting started working with these artists, 8-page isn't a monster commitment.
Mm-hmm.
you know, let's get together, jam for 8 pages. If we have fun, we'll do it again. If we don't have fun, we don't do it again. No big deal. If someone is serious about creating comics and they can't commit to doing 8 pages without a ridiculous paycheck, good luck. You know, that was really, from a pragmatic standpoint, you know, practical standpoint, that's where it started, you know. I was a no-name writer. You know, no one knew who I was at the time I started Nightmare World. So the 8-page format let us do 2 pages a week, and we were able to publish a new story online every month. And during 5 week, or 5 Thursday months, because we always posted on Thursdays, we would do like a sneak peek week of like some extra, some upcoming art, some upcoming stories, you know. But also it's fun for me as a writer to utilize that format. Because again, you know, no navel gazing, no shoe gazing, no wasting time. Start in the third act. It's an advice I give a lot of aspiring writers. They're like, oh, but you know, all this origin stuff, and oh, and you know, like, no, Captain Top Hat does all the stuff. No one will love your babies like you will. Mm-hmm. And no one cares. They just want to, they don't care about the origin. They want to be entertained. Get to the point, show something awesome, tell a great story, and get out as soon as possible.
Yeah, that's
the key.
There was a line, or there was a rule, but there was sort of an idea that's around the same thing. I'm trying to remember who said it. I want to say it was Mammoth, but I don't know if that's the case. But they're like, try and start your scene as late as possible and try and end it as early as possible. So it's like,
absolutely.
So it sort of speaks to the same thing that you're talking about. It's like, you know, get in, do the most that you can, and then get out.
You're right, because, you know, everyone loves their own babies, you know. And Harlan Ellison once said, everyone loves the smell of their own farts, you know. And it's like, of course it's important. You like it, and of course you think it's good because you wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the point. Get in, show me the most awesome thing you can, tell me the most awesome story you can, and boom, get out. Don't waste any time. And that was really the mantra for all the Nightmare World stuff we, you know, I did. It's like everything kind of starts in the third act and then ends. Done. The end. And you move on to the next thing. Nice. And we'll probably, you know, end up talking about Nightmare World in more detail later. But from a practical standpoint, as a writer, it's a good exercise to do, you know. I just did a script on commission for a publisher I haven't worked with yet previously. And the editor's like, well, can you know, could you tell the, because I told them the story, I pitched the story idea.
Mm-hmm.
It was for, I mean, I guess he posted on Facebook, because the guy's going to announce it. I'm doing a short story for Big Dog Inc. in their Critter Annual about the character Charity. And he's looking for story ideas. I'm like, this would be kind of fun, man. You know, 8 pages is like my specialty.
Mm-hmm.
So I emailed him the story idea. He emails me back. We kind of jammed on for a minute. He goes, this sound, you know, sounds pretty good. Can you do this in 8 pages? I'm like, yeah.
Do you know who I am? Hello.
Yeah, yeah. Don't you know who I am? Hunter Manning.
Yeah.
So, and landed a gig and sent the stuff today, you know, for him to look at and review, and we'll tweak it out accordingly. But, yeah, you know, it's just, it's fun format to do. I'm doing longer form stuff. The story in Dies de la Mortes, number one, is 12 pages. The Love Story is About Death is 22 pages.
Mm-hmm.
When we get to Tales of Mystery, Volume 2, it's going to be one, like, the equivalent of 1 3- or 4-issue story. Far Seeker is going to be, again, the same thing, you know. So some of the other work I'm doing is longer form, but I love short stories. I mean, there's so much you can do with them, and it's so much fun you can have doing stuff like that, you know.
Do you find stories with a longer page count easier or more difficult than stories with a shorter page count?
I think the challenge in writing a longer story is, again, keeping that breakneck, don't waste time pace.
Mm-hmm.
I love writing the short stories, you know, depending on the project. I mean, the story should meet the page count. The page count shouldn't meet the story, which I know probably doesn't initially make much sense. For example, there's a story I'm working, there's an anthology I want to contribute a story to. And I keep waffling whether it's an 8-page story or a 22-page story. A 22-page story won't fit in an anthology. You know, the 8-page story would. But what's the best vehicle to tell the story? In the case of Love Stories About Death, those kind of originated in my mind as kind of like Nightmare World stories that were too big for Nightmare World.
Mm.
And obviously, over the evolution of the problem stories about death, those stories have nothing to do with Nightmare World. They're completely unrelated.
Hmm.
So each one presents different challenges. When I do like a love stories about death story, for example, I usually give myself 5 pages to put the pedal to the metal. It's kind of like my guide to myself. You know, the first 5 pages are kind of the setup. Boom, then we go for the next 17 pages or whatever. With Nightmare World, I usually give myself 2 pages, pedal to the metal. Tales of Mystery, which the first volume is 13 8-page stories, I gave myself 1 page before I put the pedal. You know, so to me, it's all about the pacing, and it's all about how I would how I choose to pace the stories and format them. I think you guys like Garth Ennis, who are very, very good about this. If you read a 6 or 7 issue story by Garth Ennis, you're getting 6 or 7 issues worth of story.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of times writers now want to write for the trade, quote unquote. But if you don't have a 6-issue story, it shouldn't be 6 issues. And I think sometimes people pad it out and chase the dollar sign and chase the format. You shouldn't chase the format. Your story idea and your story should dictate the format.
Mm.
First, it really depends, the next Tales of Mystery thing we're going to be doing, Tales of Mystery Carmageddon, there is no way I could tell it in 8 pages, there's no way I could tell it in 22 pages, and after 13 8-page stories, people want to see something a little bit bigger from him, and they're going to see a bigger story about that character and about that universe. But the story warrants it. The story after that, I may do a one-shot, if the story warrants it. So the story has to dictate the form.
One of the things that always sort of bugged me about writing for the trade is like, well, you could have a trade of like a 2-issue story and then a couple of one-shots and then another 2-issue story. Like, it doesn't have to be 6 issues of one story. Like, it could be an anthology trade, in which case you've got, like, again, a 3-issue story and then like a 2-issue story and then like a 1-issue story, And it's supposed to like, well... That's sort of right, but that's just personal pet peeve.
Right, and people are warming up to anthologies more. I think for a long time people have been scared of anthologies.
Mm-hmm.
When I was starting, I know people were like, "Oh, anthologies! Why would you want to do an anthology?" I'm like, "Well, it's really not an anthology since I'm writing every story."
Right.
But anthologies typically suffer, whether it be fair or not, under the stigmata of poor quality of art. There's always a dud. And you read an anthology and there's always a dozen. Well, it doesn't have to be that way. Are there really that many bad Twilight Zone episodes, for example? Really, there's not.
Yeah.
There's some that are maybe not quite as good as the others that are really awesome, but, but again, that comes down to quality control, too. If you're going to put out an anthology, you need to play to the strength of the anthology and put out a bunch of awesome stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And for a long time, anthologies kind of served as fillers and throwaway stuff, which just enrages me, so... Just my little 2 cents on that topic.
So we've sort of said the name a couple of times, but let's talk about Right or Wrong for a few minutes. The collection of your Newsarama columns has come out. I'm looking at it right now. It is Right or Wrong, A Writer's Guide to Creating Comics by Dirk Manning.
Yes.
One of the things I liked about this book, and even it says sort of in the subheading here, A Writer's Guide to Creating Comics, it's a little bit of technical stuff, but it's mostly putting forth a certain mindset, putting forth a certain, not aesthetic, but a certain work ethic.
Yeah, and the way I kind of try to tell people about the book is, it's 30% practice, 70% theory. This is a book for people that know the practice of writing comics.
Yes.
They know how to format a script. They know how to write. And this book is really specifically geared for people like, okay, I've read Understanding Comics, I've read the Eisner stuff, whatever, I know how to put a script together. How do I create comics?
Yes.
This isn't just a book for people that want to learn how to write. There are plenty of books out there already, books like that out there already. There are no books out there that talk about how to create comics as a writer.
Yes.
It talks about the theory of that, like you said, the mindset of it, and how to get out there and manage your teams and... the first chapter of the book is called Why Comics. To me, that was the only way to really start the book. It's like, let's talk about this. Why do you want to write comics? That's the first question you have to ask yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to be more than, I love comics. Well, yeah, cool. You love video games, too. Do you really want to commit the next 10 years of your life to making a video game? You know, I mean, so we just kind of go from there. And then, like you said, touch on script writing and touch on other things, but really get into the fundamentals of how to really make a comic book. My goal is anyone reading this book, when they get done, they will have the tools necessary that they can go out and make a comic.
You can point to your own success and say, look, I'm not just pulling this out of thin air. This is, you know, this is what I've achieved. You know, if you consider that a success, this is how I did it, right?
Right.
And I've read your book and, of course, sort of followed your career, so I can see that it worked in that case. I've also been fortunate enough to be around other independent comic creators and be around them at different points in their career, and I see a lot of parallels between the idea that the writer being the team leader, being, you know, production manager of projects that he's working on. Not that he's, you know, placing himself better than the artist, because I think a lot of early writers or younger writers, beginning writers, think of themselves as like, I'm writing this script and the artist is going to serve my script. And you're like, yeah, don't go into it thinking like that. That's really counterproductive.
It is. And it's something a lot of writers suffer from.
Mm-hmm. It's tough love in the book, but it is love. You know?
It is love, yeah. I'm just being honest. You know, yeah. People are going to, I tell anybody, you know, I'm very vocal about this. I'm very passionate about this. I'm like, if you want to create comics, spend $16 on yourself.
Yeah.
You know, go buy this book. You know, I mean, I did this column online for free for over 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not like trying to turn around and like bilk people out of money at this point. You know, almost everything I've done, the vast majority of the comic work I've done has appeared online for free first.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but
and it's still online, actually.
Yeah. Bulk of it is.
Right.
So it's something where it's like, you know, I'm not saying like buy my book because I want to make the money on it. It's like, no. If you really want to write comics, you want to create comics, this is everything I could possibly tell anyone ever about doing it. As you mentioned, and you and I have kind of, you know, run in the same circles a little bit here and there. Our paths have kind of, you know, indirectly crossed a little bit, you know. But, you know, yeah, I mean, I've been doing this for 10 years, and I'm not writing a Marvel or DC book, you know, and I talk about this in the book.
Right.
I've never pitched a Marvel or DC.
Yeah.
You know, I'm doing my own thing right now. Maybe that day will come. Maybe it won't. I don't know. But I'm enjoying what I'm doing right now.
Right.
I'm enjoying doing online comics and publishing and doing the convention circuit and getting the right, you know, the stuff I want to write when I want to write it, you know. Here's everything I could, 216 pages of everything I could possibly tell you about knowing you can write to making it happen, managing a team, working with other professionals and trying to get people out of perspective. And you're right. I mean, it genuinely comes from a spot of love. I mean, one thing that people can read right or wrong book, there's no one on this earth that could tell you that this wasn't a passion project for me.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody. I mean, I'll say that right now. I mean, whether you like what I have to say or not, agree with it or not, this is a passion project.
Yeah. And you said these have been online since I think you started in like 2006, and I've read them online for, you know, a couple of years before this. I went out and bought the book, one just to have them, but in reading the book and then rereading it before we talked, a lot of it has been reworked and updated. So it's not just like, oh, I can read it for free online. It's like, well, sort of you can, but in some ways almost like the Nightmare World print collections are remastered, revamped from the stuff that you can get online. Sure, you can read the online stuff, but there's value in this print book.
Yeah, and honestly, it's to the point now where a lot of the original online columns that make up, you know, the book, I think I'm in the high 70s.
Yeah.
I make an online column that's going to be coming back here pretty soon on a monthly basis. I did a lot of the early columns that make up the book aren't even online anymore. NewsRama switched servers, and we lost a lot of the original content.
Hmm.
But, yeah, this is like the definitive – one of the reasons I waited so long – put out this book was even when I was writing the column initially, I was on a journey, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really obsessive about not presenting something till it's done. It's the artist in me, you know. But it got to the point when I was putting out books through Image Comics Shadowline and things like that, and I had been having several books published. I'm like, okay, I can talk to people about how to make comics, how to create comics. There's a little number one on the side of the book. Eventually, in a year or two, or, you know,
there'll
be another book.
Yeah.
What do you know?
I did not know that. I read the book. I did not read the spine, apparently.
Well, that's good. I mean, it hasn't been sitting on a shelf collecting dust.
Oh, no.
But,
it's been It's been sitting on my desk and on my nightstand. So I know the cover very well, but I did not know that. I did not know
But, you know, the next Right or Wrong book will be about, okay, now that you're creating comics, now what? The convention circuit, promoting your work, navigating, you know, maybe Kickstarter, all that, you know, the next phase of it, you know. But, yeah, it's just, you know, if you want to create comics, now you know you can write, but you don't know where to find artists. You don't know, you can't seem to get an artist to finish a project with you.
Yeah.
Things like that. I mean, here it is, man. You know, boom, this is the answer. Joe Casale used to say years ago, in regards to breaking the comics, there is no spoon.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, this is a, maybe there wasn't. But here's at least everything I can tell you about making your own comics, which is the first step into getting into writing for Marvel or DC or whatever. If that's even your goal, if that's what you want to do, which I talk about in the book as well, is a whole other, you know, kind of myth busting on that topic.
Yeah. One of the things I like about your approach, and again, I've seen it in creators that I've been fortunate enough to sort of watch as their careers have grown. And one of them is Josh Fialkov. But he was always very creator first. You know, he didn't get into this saying, oh, man, I want to write for DC. I want to write for Marvel. He's like, I want to write. I want to write comics. And I want to do that to the best of my ability. And that's one of the things that in your book, one of the points you keep pressing and making is that it comes from the creator first. So don't, you know, tell your own stories. Be, you know, you are the, not you are the commodity, but, you know, you are the unique one. You know, mm-hmm. Share what makes you unique with other people, and then they will be interested in that and then come to you. Don't lose yourself trying to get to telling somebody else's stories. We've got somebody else telling somebody else's stories. That's somebody else. Be you.
Right. And I'm sure Josh could testify to this, or anybody that's been tapped by Marvel or DC could testify to this. They went out, created their own work, and it got noticed by editors who said, hey, we'd like to see what you can do with some of our corporately owned characters.
Right.
You know, and I'm not saying that in a bad way. I'm saying that's a fact, Jack. You know, I mean, that's what it is. But if you want to get – if your goal in life is to write Spider-Man.
Yeah. You're screwed because Dan Slott's already doing it.
Yeah, Dan Slott was put on – like I say, right in the book.
Yeah.
Dan Slott was put on this earth to write Spider-Man. But that being said, that aside, the only way to even have the tiny, tiny chance that exists of that happening is to create your own comics. You can't – Marvel and DC won't read your pitches.
Yeah.
They won't. They'd be foolhardy to.
Yeah.
They'd be opening themselves to monstrous liabilities.
Right.
You know, and it just is this stuff that, you know, I mean, so again, why comics? If you want to create comics then because you want to write Batman someday, okay, I'm not going to say that's a bad goal because that's your goal. That's personal.
Mm-hmm.
But even if you want to do that, you've got to start by creating your own comics. Or here's an idea. Make your own Batman. You know, I mean, not exactly. Don't get sued to be a scumbag about it. But what is, you know, and again, I talk about this in the book. What is it about Batman that attracts you to that character? How can you tell stories with those same themes, those same elements, but your own way, your own world?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and go from there.
For people that may not be of that mindset, it can be a very eye-opening sort of thing to have you constantly reminding them, you know, be yourself. And this really matched up with sort of my thinking on that before. So to see a book like this that is so helpful in a lot of ways, also pushing that agenda, but reminding people, bring your own voice, do your own thing. And you can achieve success doing your own thing. If you are persistent, if you have the work ethic, you know, you can do this. I have done this. You can also do this. Even if it's completely different from what I'm doing. And that's the other thing. You don't say, this is how you create horror comics. So this is, it's not, you know, it's the Dirk Manning way, but you don't have to do what Dirk Manning did.
No, yeah. Not at all. And again, you know, people are always wondering, how do I get there? How do I get to this point? And like I said, there's only one Dirk Manning. My grandfather always says to me, you know, when they made you, they broke the mold. But that's true of everybody, you know. Each one of us have our own unique stories to tell. Name of the World is one of my stories. Tales of Mystery is a story that only I can tell. Love Stories About Death, Farseer, on and on. Those are stories only I can tell. Even Tevas Angel Neil from Dies de los Muertos. That's a story only I can tell.
Mm-hmm.
No one else can tell that story. You might be able to tell stories like it. You may be able to tell stories that are thematically similar.
Mm-hmm.
and my story. And each one of the people out there that want to create comics have stories only they can tell. And absolutely, that's what I keep pushing in the Right or Wrong book. Tell your story. But then to do that, of course, you need to assemble an art team. Okay, let's talk about that. I put right in the book the most current information available. Here's where to go online to find artists. But then here's how to talk to artists. Here's the mindset you should have when approaching artists and talking to them. There are other professionals. And Right or Wrong. Or with a right with, we should say right with a W.
Yes.
W-R-I-T.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's on Amazon. It's sold out through Diamond. You can get it on Amazon. If you want to create a comic, show it yourself to get it.
So let's talk about some of the work you've created. We want to start with Nightmare World. Let's start with Nightmare World. We talked about it enough,
so.
Okay.
We'll start with that.
Nightmare World, the elevator pitch.
Nightmare World is a series of 52 stories, all written by me, each story is drawn by a different artist team. And what's cool about Nightmare World is each story is a different genre or subgenre of horror, and they're each a totally standalone story, but as you read the series, so far there's 3 trade paperback graphic novels out through Image Comics Shadowline. Mm-hmm. But as you read the 13 stories in each of those 3 books, all these individual standalone stories all weave into one giant story as well. About Lucifer Awakening Cthulhu to kickstart the Armageddon and all sorts of other crazy stuff.
I mean, you've talked about Nightmare World a lot sort of online, so there are a couple of specific questions, maybe even sort of process questions that I had that I kind of wanted to ask. So you started Nightmare World as sort of your own showcase, and you wanted to do, and you talk about this in the book a bit, but you started it with, like, let's say six stories. You know, those went out, and those did really well. At what point were you really like, okay, this can – at what point did that sort of become sort of self-sustainable, and you're like, okay, I can then get to the story that I maybe, you know, wanted to do?
Tell the big story.
Right. At what point did the big story kick in your head? Because if you'd have started doing the big – if you'd started even seeding the big story with the 6 – because, I mean, you start seeding it from, like, the first story.
Right. Looking back, right, exactly. When I started publishing online, I always knew in my mind it'd be so cool to do a series like this, to have everything tied together. But again, I was a nobody. I was just starting out, and there was no guarantee I could get that far.
Mm-hmm.
But in my mind, I always knew. But I really wanted to play to the strengths of the artists I was working with at the time, who largely were called from, were studio mates of mine through Golden Goat Studios, and or then eventually more through the digital webbing forums.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you exactly when it was. When I got to story number 25,
okay,
and everyone was just firing on full steam, and we were having fun, and we were just – it was rock and roll, man. I mean, that's the only way to describe it. I mean, it was rock and roll. We were just having a blast. We were going ahead, basically, exposure. We're having fun. I would talk to the artists. What do you want to draw? And they would talk to me and said, would you write me a story about this? We jump this through with dragons. Man, I'll write you a dragon story. I'll find a way.
Mm-hmm.
when we got to that point, I realized, I'm like, we can go all the way with this.
Mm-hmm.
And I let everybody know when I said, I told them, I'm like, listen, none of you know this. There's a big story here. And I planted little seeds throughout, but I want to bring it home. But it's going to take another roughly 25 more stories, and I just want to bring this home.
Okay.
Everyone said, yeah, man, we're on board. And we just killed it. Everyone stepped up, and we just brought it home. And, if you read them, like I said, we have 3 trade paperbacks out through Shadowline at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
There are 13 more stories that will eventually would be the last Nightmare World volume when it gets published. But even in those first 3 trade paperbacks, you can see the through line of this big story we were telling. And but it was at 25, and I'm like, man, and we were just rocking,
yeah.
You know, I'm like, let's do this, guys. I'm like, let's, but I asked Mike, you know, if we do this, you know, I need to know, are you guys willing to finish this journey with me, and let's bring it home? And people were just really enthusiastic, and everyone was trying to outdo each other, and we were like a rock band, man. It was just rock and roll. It was a lot of fun. And, it was this really neat opportunity. It let them showcase their work, let me showcase my work, and we had fun. And we all had fun contributing to this giant quilt, this giant, you know, just tapestry of this really cool series that that, you know, so many of the artists, it was so funny, even said, I'm not a fan of horror comics, but I love this series, which I think in a lot of ways is one of the best compliments I could get because, yeah, you know, it's good horror. It's not just stupid torture porn or slasher fiction or whatever.
But you did write a slasher story for it, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's one of them. That's a subgenre of horror that it would not be right for me to ignore. Right. But it's a funny. It's a parody of the slasher stories, you know, Knee Deep in the Dead. Even the title was just, like, really? But, yeah, I wanted to cover every conceivable subgenre of horror and do that through, you know, 52 different stories. People say, there's 52 different subgenres of horror? Yeah. Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. There's probably more
slasher.
Than that.
Yeah, you got slasher. You got zombies. You got vampires. You got ghosts. You've got Irish folklore. You've got fairies. Did you have fairies? Like, you know, the little mythical beings with wings?
Mm-hmm.
That's some scary stuff when you get into the origins of it. You know, I did that. You know, we just did we did a Sherlock Holmes story. We did a Western story. We did a ninja versus samurai, you know, throughout the course. We had dragons throughout the course of the series. I got to show the huge umbrella that is horror. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. The other question, or the other sort of thing that sort of blows my mind about this is, one, the sheer output. So you had 13 times 4, so 52 stories, each of them 8 pages or 9 pages with a cover.
Right.
You published 2 pages a week,
mm-hmm.
right? So you started, yeah. 2002, I think, is when...
Oh, when that started. Yeah, we started about 2002, yeah.
Once you started the ball rolling, was there ever any significant delay?
There were a couple. One was when, and it was never really due to not having the art. Actually, it was more technical issues than anything. The big delay we had is we had a gap for about a year, which just destroyed me because the website got co-opted. This company went out of business and things like that. That was combined with a Titanic computer failure on my end.
Oh, is that the one you talk about in the book? Oh, okay.
Yeah. You know, but mainly like the website and the material getting kind of like held hostage on there and it was all stored on there, you know. But other than that, mainly it just came with a lot of pre-planning and a lot of enthusiasm from everyone involved and a lot of hard work, you know, juggling cats, you know, keeping everything going.
That's the other thing that just blows my mind. I mean, once you started that, you're like, okay, the ball's going. We need 2 pages a week. So obviously you have some lead time, but keeping that lead time and spinning so many different plates of all the different artists and stuff that you work with, and not even just, okay, the artists. So there's, let's say you've worked with like 26 other artists. You're like, all right, 26 other people. You also have to deal with, or not deal with, you also have to include the colorists, the letterers. So like multiply that times maybe two or three, the amount of people, the amount of, you know, when you're like, hey, I'm just the writer, and you're like, no, you are the, you know, you're the traffic cop, you're the, you know, and creators, you know, independent creators, a lot of times, or almost all the times, have to take on so many other responsibilities.
Well, yeah, I was the editor, I was the cheerleader, I was the team manager, I was everything. At the end of the day, this was my baby. People were joining with Nightmare World because it was fun, they enjoyed doing it. You know, artists, I talk about this in the book, artists like to draw.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's why they do it. I like to write. That's why I do it. Artists that want to work in comics wanted to produce material that could get them noticed, to get them paying work or bigger jobs or whatever.
Mm.
My goal was to provide them with work that would help them along as fellow professionals to get towards that goal. That was my obligation. That was my duty. That was my mantra. So that was really first and foremost what I was really trying to do. Additionally, as you mentioned, you know, I had to promote the work myself.
Mm-hmm.
Anything was my baby. I'm the one out there promoting it. I'm the one out there going to message boards. And, you know, Jim Reddington, my letterer, my best friends and the guy that letters all the Nightmare World, the majority of the Nightmare World stuff, you know, there were times that we would literally be, you know, sitting at our respective computers. And, like, at 1 o'clock in the morning, the colored page comes in Wednesday night, Thursday morning. You know, we're like, oh. Okay, bottom on Yahoo. Hey, you know, calling. okay, I got the page, and hurry up and throw the letters on it, and then go to bed. You know, we laugh about that all the time. It's like, man, what were we? Because it went up Thursday. You know, Thursday was our day, and if we had to be up till 1 or 2 in the morning getting stuff done, that's what we did. You know, but that passion was there, and by God, we did it. You know, yeah. And the results speak for themselves. We have these three great trade paperbacks out through, you know, Shadowline that are also available on Amazon.com.
Yeah.
Nightmare World, tell your friends. But it was a ridiculously insane project, but it was also some of the best times of my life.
Right.
It was just such fun to do that. Even doing like some of the love stories about death now, working with other artists. It's nowhere near the caliber of Nightmare World. But we were all friends. I'm lucky enough to still count almost everyone I worked with are friends of mine.
Mm-hmm.
This last year, San Diego Comic Con, I got to meet up with Mark Winters and Jason Meek, who I haven't seen in, probably 8-9 years, maybe, roughly, since I did last seen him in person. We got to go have dinner and just hang out, and it was just so nice to see him again, you know. So it's just cool, man, you know. And there's some artists who I've worked with all the time, like Len O'Grady's a good friend of mine. He lived in Ireland when we started working together. He now lives in the States. We still haven't met in person.
Yeah.
He's one of my good friends. We talk all the time. We email, we talk on the phone, whatever. We haven't met in person yet. And we worked together for like, he did the second
story.
The third. He did Run Like Hell, the third ever Nightmare World story. That was 2002. We still haven't met in person. That's my dude. That's one of my best friends, but it's just a different world, you know.
Okay, so Nightmare World, you get to tell your, you know, your big grand opus. Yes.
Magnus opus.
Tales of Mystery, which we should say is spelled Tales of MR period space RHEE.
Yes, Mystery is the main name. See what I did there? So witty, right or wrong, Mystery.
Yeah, well, Josh, his production company was called Horse and Buggy, but it was always spelled HORSE.
Right.
And Buggy. and he was like, that was like the worst decision. I was like, hey, look at how clever I am. And he's like, nobody was able to spell it right.
Right.
And
funny with Tales of Mystery, how many people don't catch it until, like, I've had people all the time, like, I was telling somebody about it, and it just dawned on me.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh, Mystery, that's really funny. They realize it, but they just didn't click.
Yeah, because it's not spelled in a way that you would sort of take it from reading. You have to sort of say it in your head as you're reading it, and some people do that and some people don't. So it takes people a while to sort of laugh at the joke or notice the joke. So Tales of Mystery, kind of a follow-up? How would you, you know,
it was kind of like, I guess, the next step in the evolution of what I was doing. With Tales of Mystery, what I was looking at doing was, in Nightmare World, one of the things that people would always ask me is, when are you going to do, like, longer-form stories, you know?
Mm-hmm.
When are we going to see more of these characters? In Nightmare World, there's 52 stories. You don't see any one character in more than 3 or 4, maybe.
Yeah.
You know, you see Lucifer in a couple, you see Brian Carter in a couple, you see Vanessa in a couple. But by and large, you don't really see characters more than once or twice, which I call that real life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you know, sometimes you only meet these people a couple times and that's it.
Yeah.
So Tales of Mystery was me doing, again, 8-page stories, for volume one at least. It was 13 8-page stories, all following one character. And Tales of Mystery does take place in that same kind of, the same setting, the same universe, same world, where you have, this is 7 years after the events of Nightmare World. Here's this guy that's a paranormal troubleshooter trying to kind of survive and thrive in a world that generally doesn't want to acknowledge that any remnants of that stage of events in the world still exists. The terrorists are gone. The monsters are gone. And he's a guy that knows, the monsters aren't gone.
Mm.
And people contact him sometimes to deal with these things. But it's much more a character-driven story. He's just a really infectiously addictingly cool character, you know, and every what I wanted to do with this is every time you read a new mystery story in that first set, you learn something else about the guy, and it becomes ideally more and more fascinating and ultimately pretty tragic as you go. He does some really he makes some pretty big mistakes throughout the course of the series, and you know, it's not a hero book; it's a horror book. You know,
as you
it ends in a really horrible spot for our main character, but hopefully that made people very emotionally charged about it.
When you say end, you mean the first chapter ended?
Yeah, the first chapter. Yeah, the first set of 13 stories. Yeah.
Okay, because there's a follow-up that's coming.
Yes.
Okay. Why don't you tell us a little bit about, or why don't you give us a date or whatever, if you can, on
2000, I'm looking at hopefully 2013, okay. Which I know is like 10 more months, but
yeah.
Seth the Moose is illustrating it. It's called Tales of Mystery, Carmageddon.
Okay.
It is the follow-up to Tales of Mystery, the first volume, which we kind of call Procreation of the Wicked.
Hmm.
I mentioned this once or twice before. It's primarily a flashback story. And
okay.
It's what Mystery did during the Armageddon, when the legions of hell and the other dimensions invaded Earth, as seen in Nightmare World.
Right.
Where was Mystery and what was he doing? It's a very, again, emotional story. It's a very fun story. There's going to be a lot of big and a lot of big emotion, you know, big action, big emotion, I guess, is kind of and big horror is kind of, I guess, the through line of Carmageddon. And it helps just, you learn a little bit more about why he is the way he is. It's fun. I mean, it's really good. Seth the Moose is just, who I've worked with on several Nightmare World stories, as well as an installment of Love Stories About Death.
Mm.
Doing a little bit of a different take on his art here. I mean, it's still his art,
mm-hmm.
a little more Tophy, a little more Alex Toller, Alex Tophy. But just, man, I mean, I just got another colored page today, and oh, it just looks so good. And this goes before, too, what you said about working ahead. You know, we're getting a bunch of it in the bank before, if we choose to launch online first,
right?
Before we launch. But I'm really excited people see it. And this would be this is going to be like the equivalent of a 3 or 4 issue miniseries. Not broken up into little stories, but just one big story about, you know, for 3 days, it was hell on earth. What was we doing? You know, and I guess kind of that's all I'm going to say about for now. I don't want to give too much more away. But at least it'll go to what it's about. But it's he's a cool character. He's a lot of fun, and I can't wait to re-unleash him, upon the world.
Okay. Going from writing short stories that have obviously an ever-evolving or ever-rotating, not even rotating, but a new cast in almost every story, focusing on a character like Mr. Ree for an extended period, did you learn more about the character as you wrote him for this extended period than you thought you were going to? Because he's the first sort of long-form character that you've written.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And he's definitely a character. There's a certain archetype for like the bad boy, kind of damaged, mistrusting loner.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and whether that be Wolverine or whether that be Hellblazer or whatever, you know, Batman, you know, there's all different ways to take that trope. With Ree, I really wanted to get into more of a character study about this person and why he is what he's like, but tell really engaging stories about it. Again, I don't believe in navel gazing. I don't believe in, you know, just because I like Ree doesn't mean anyone else will.
Mm-hmm.
But rather, I want to tell, first and foremost, tell these engaging short stories, but also through telling these engaging short stories, tell the story of a person who would really live through these events. And a while back, someone talked to me at a convention. He goes, I want to talk about Mr. Ree for a minute. I'm like, have at it.
Yeah.
And ended up being a psychology major. And he was really getting into the psychology of this character and talking about, like, post-traumatic stress disorder and things like that. In fact, when I talked to him online, the first volume wasn't done online yet. He goes, I don't want to know where it's going. But like I said, he's showing all these classic signs of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Mm.
I'm like, yeah, you know, exactly. It's just fascinating to see, like, this. What's going on with this guy? And, well, yeah, because it's very easy to write stories about people who fight monsters or fight villains or save the day. But it's very one-dimensional to assume they go do this stuff and they go home and eat dinner, you know, and play video games. I mean, how do you live in a world where, just to take the first story, and people can read Tales of Mystery at ShadowlineOnline.com, go to the webcomic section, boom, Tales of Mystery. You read that first eight-page story. How do you go to a house call, more or less, find out that this guy is channeling demons through the unborn fetuses of pregnant women to try to control demons that way, in small little bodies? How do you deal with that and then just go home and click on the TV?
Yeah, that's messed up.
How do you live in a world like that, man? That's the first story, you know?
Yeah.
And one of the things we wanted to do with the whole series is get into this, that frame of reference about, you know, Wolverine does all these horrible things, or Batman, you know, I mean, lives, you know, and the Joker's out there, and all these terrible things happen. When you really deal with, you know, and it's this Lovecraftian style of storytelling, you know, how long can you see this stuff before you just start to crack? And if you start to crack, how do you hold yourself together? You know, and that's really one of the underlying themes of Tales of Mystery, is that Lovecraftian horror. Here you are out there dealing with these impossible things, these horrible, horrible, horrible things going on. How do you, and then being totally cut off from the rest of the world because of what you know exists, you know, how do you live in a world like that?
Yeah.
That was one of the, and I think that's something that people really picked up on in this series is, you know, there's a story later in the series where Ari is, has a meeting with a ghost, and it's the ghost of the ghost of the daughter of a friend of his, and does some, make some decisions that, I hate to say, come back to haunt him, but why not?
Yeah.
How do you live in a world where ghosts are trapped here? How do you live in a world where people do these horrible things? And how would you survive? And how would you cope with that? And you can do it for a while. I mean, how do you sleep, man? How do you sleep knowing this that crazy stuff's out there? So that's really what the theme, which I'm a big theme guy, it was about in Volume 1 of Tales of Mystery, as well as how some of the decisions he makes lead to ultimately his kind of undoing at the end of Volume 1.
Would you prefer that people read Nightmare World before reading Mystery?
I mean, it doesn't. Honestly, it doesn't matter. People can read, you know, Tales of Mystery first, read Nightmare World first. If you read Nightmare World first, you'll get some of the Easter eggs in Tales of Mystery. There's a couple characters from Nightmare World that pop up in Mystery, more for the sake of fun than anything else. They could just have easily been other characters, but if I had to write one comic for the rest of my life, only one, it would be Tales of Mystery at this point. I would write that. I would write him until the natural end of the series, which does eventually have a natural organic end. But even as I've given away just in, you know, in this interview, the second volume is primarily a flashback, you know, but, you know, so I can tell stories about the past, tell stories about the future, whatever, you know, for all people know by reading volume one, you've read the last mystery story and now it's just how we all got to this point, you know?
So in telling a flashback tale, how do you, as a writer, just sort of keep yourself from sort of like, okay, well, the flashback, obviously X, Y, and Z is not going to happen because we know we sort of know what happens after this. How do you as a writer sort of mentally say, okay, to be successful in this, I need to sort of counteract what the reader is sort of bringing to this?
Yeah, you know, I mean, you know,
answer my own question? I just answered my own question.
No, I mean, you know mystery is not going to die
right in
Farmageddon. Obviously. Right. And if he does die, he's going to come back somehow because there are other stories that have been told that take place after this one. But, as I say in Tales of Mystery Volume 1, there are fates in this world worse than death.
Sure.
You know, death is a cop-out. The point of reading Tales of Mystery is not, and someday he'll die. Maybe. Maybe the end of Volume 1 is the end of the series. And I'm just going to tell nothing but flashback stories about the character. I will say there's a framing sequence in Carmageddon that will kind of put things in perspective in the present day. But, yeah, you know, I mean, if the only thing a reader is worried about is this character going to die, they're reading it for the wrong reasons. Spider-Man you know, newsflash, Peter Parker is not dead. Peter Parker will never die.
Right.
It is not. It will never, ever, ever, ever happen. Right. Ever. You know, that his quote-unquote death in Amazing Spider-Man. And again, Dan Slott's awesome. He's a great writer. It lasted an issue before Peter Parker's ghost comes back.
Yeah.
You know, and his part of the book is just as much as Dr. Octopus is part of the book.
Yeah.
You know, that's fine. Yeah. That's the point, though. Just tell good stories, man. It doesn't matter who lives and who dies. It doesn't matter if you bring back the Phoenix 1,000 times. It doesn't matter if Robin's dead or not dead. Just tell good stories. Tell stories that have a strong theme that resonate, that are entertaining.
Right. Well, speaking of stories that have a theme that resonate, that are entertaining, let's talk about stories about death really quickly.
Stories about death? Yeah.
Is there any connection between the stories? Like, in a way that, like, the Nightmare World stories were are just sort of...
I know you can't see my hands right now, but I'm, like, waving off, like, no!
Okay,
no! I've done that. I'm good. These are just rather 22-page one-shots. So far, we did the zombie story, the pro wrestling story, the Guardian Angel story. We have several more.
Those are the three that I've read so far.
Yeah, those are three we have out, and then we're going to be putting out some more soon, whether it be online, in print, or both.
Okay.
In fact, I just got the cover for the here's a new exclusive. We have a space story. That's kind of the general theme of it. And I just got the cover for that. Oh my goodness!
Who's the artist for that?
Owen Gianni. Owen and I have been friends for many, 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 many years. We worked together on all of one Nightmare World story, and he did one cover that is lost to the ages now. I know. I probably still have it somewhere. I wouldn't want me to ever show it to anybody if it even even popped. He did the original cover for Mama's Boy, which was the first ever Nightmare World story back in the day. But we've been wanting to work together. But we've been on parallel paths. He's been doing his thing. I've been doing my thing. And this is going to be probably the first of a couple of things we're doing together. Mm. And then Rich Bonk is doing I don't want to say what his story is yet. But it's two great tastes that taste great together. And if anyone knows Rich and those kind of stuff he likes to draw, it's everything he likes to draw. And I'll leave it at that. And then I got a couple other ones in the works right now with some other artists that I've never worked with before. So it's just really exciting. And again, we took a brief intermission from that, mainly for the right or wrong stuff, because some of the other stuff I have coming out right now. And then we're going to definitely continue Love Stories About Death, whether it be in print, digital, or both, or a combination there. But again, that's available at shadowlineonline.com as well.
I read them last night. They're interesting. Seth has he did the Wrestler story, and then Anthony Peruzzo.
Yes.
Did the zombie story. That looked really, really good. Definitely pushing some sort of Walking Dead buttons. I will say there was some Tony Moore. Is feeling sort of a Tony Moore vibe, but there was also just some. Not a wash, but just sort of like being online, getting to have the color and stuff in there. It was sort of pushing some buttons, but definitely being its own, you know, its own story.
It was like I talked about in the right or wrong, but that story I wanted to tell for a long time. And I figured my original plan was when I got done with Nightmare World, I'd do Love Stories About Death.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, I did Tales of Mystery Volume 1 next, which gives you an idea of how far ahead I planned this stuff, you know?
Yeah.
But then when Walking Dead, in the meantime, Walking Dead, the comic came out and got huge. And I'm like, man, I can never tell my zombie story.
Right.
And I was talking to Peruzzo one day, who we worked together on a couple different stories. He goes, yeah, man, I really would love to draw a zombie story. I've just been itching to draw a zombie story. I'm like, yeah, I know, it's a bummer. I had this, like, awesome zombie story I really wanted to tell, but I can't tell it now because it's going to look too similar to Walking Dead. And he goes, well, what's the story? And I told him the story, and he's like, I'm not working with you again until you write that script for me. Son of a bitch.
Right.
But I'm really glad he pushed me to write it, because I'm just tickled with how the story turned out. And then, you know, working with Howie Noel on Inability to Cope, that's a story that I wanted to get to forever, and he does mainly caricature art primarily, and he does an online comic called Terra Normal, which I just love. So getting to him on that story and see what he did with that story was just a lot of fun.
Yeah, that story's messed up. I don't even really want to.
Yes!
Like I don't want to say anything about it, but.
Well, the first page is the main character dead from suicide.
Yeah, that's not the messed up part. Like, that's really not. Yeah, yeah. Seeing the teenage girl with her wrist slit dead in the bathtub. Yeah, that's not messed up. That's not the messed.
Yeah. Oh no, that's not the worst part of the story.
Yeah, yeah.
Not by a long shot.
Just the. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But there's another character in there that you have certain expectations about, and those expectations are, shall we say, shifted. Like it's sort of in character, but you're like, that's taking it to, oh, that's just not right. You know? I don't want to say any more than that, but that was, I read them in reverse order. Like, that was the first one I clicked on, and I was like, oh, okay, I'm going to read these. I read them, and I was like, that is just fucked up. I'm sorry. That was like, that is fucked up. And then I read second one, and I'm like, okay, that's kind of fucked up. And then I read the zombies right, and I'm like, oh, that's fucked up. So.
Well, good. Yeah. Well, and again, it's horror. It's supposed to have that reaction about, wow, this is really moving and woo. Because, you know, there's a lot of people try to write horror and it becomes monster fantasy.
Right.
Which is fine. Fantasy is fine. I've done fantasy comics. That's fine. But Love Stories About Death is exactly what it sounds like. Love stories about death.
Yeah.
That's what they're about. Every additional story that comes out is about that, whether it be outer space, whether it be this, whether it be whatever. That's what you're getting, and exploring how those two things intertwine in different ways, you know, whether it be love for a child, love for your family, love for your best friend, romantic love, lust, whatever, and how death plays into that stuff. So when you say effed up, I'm taking it as a huge compliment. I just want to.
Yeah, please take that as a compliment, because, yeah, for that type of story, I mean, like, if, you know, that's the reaction you want. You're like, you want to unsettle. You want to just be like, man, that's.
And I didn't want to just rob people of some little stupid twist ending at the end, like, what's this? But rather just tell these stories that just unwind and evolve, and you get to the end, and I'm like, ooh.
Yeah, I mean, it's, and the pacing for that story is, because, I mean, there is a sort of surprise on the last page. But there's something about two-thirds of the way through where you're just like, oh, that's sort of, oh, man, no, no. Oh, that is fucked.
Yes,
so,
it is, yes.
Yeah. So,
right.
And again,
cool, man. So
obviously that was, again, you were talking about, you know, these sort of stories are too big for a Nightmare World story.
Yeah.
Taking that in particular, and again, not really wanting to talk about it, but did you feel that if you were going to tell that story, just pacing wise, okay, you've got the last page sort of reveal, but then the really sort of
inability to cope.
So like the messed up, the messed up sort of reveal on, let's say, the fifth page. Did you then feel like, okay, I physically don't have enough pages to set up the reality sort of before that to give the power to the okay. So it really is just sort of about real estate.
It's kind of what we talked about earlier. The story needs to dictate the form. Mm-hmm. These are not 8-page stories. Same with Countdown to Extinction, which is a zombie story. Same with A Rush of Blood to the Head, which was my pro wrestling story. Mm-hmm. Same with the other love stories about death that are coming out. There is no way to tell those stories properly in 8 pages. 22-page stories. And it's so funny because, like, with the zombie story, with the wrestling story, not so much with an inability to cope, because it's more the circle closes upon itself nicely.
Mm-hmm.
But the other two, I've had multiple people ask me, are we going to see more of these characters? I'm like, no.
Yeah.
I'm like, what? They get all mad. I'm like, that's the story. That's it. But you can tell more. Yeah, I could.
But I'm not going
that's
to.
That's the story. I'm like, oh, they get mad. And I start laughing my evil laugh again. I'm like, well, that's cool, though. I mean, good. You know, but if you ever want to, I'd love to read more about, you know, after what happens to Countdown to Extinction, or after what happens next in Rush of Blood to the Head. Well, that's the story.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow, that's fucked up. So
it's a sign of exasperation.
Yeah. So talking about digital comics, obviously you started, you know, back in, you know, 2002 ish.
Mm-hmm.
The internet was a different, you know, was a different place. Digital comics were in a completely different place. Now
there
that we're
social
seeing,
media.
Yeah, but even in just like the execution of digital comics, in the last year and a half or so, we've been seeing slowly people starting to incorporate like the, I don't want to say like the thrill bent version, but like the exploration of digital comics as something more than just full page print comics put up online. I don't know. Have you seen any of the, like the thrill bent, like the.
Yeah. And I think it's, I mean, it's really cool that people are doing that and continuing to explore, the options we have with technology.
Do you have any interest in taking that type of a approach with a story?
No, I hate to say it, but not at the moment. Okay. I'm more interested in putting the comics online and then taking them to print, because that's what I wanted to do in 2002 before finding out the technology wasn't there yet.
Mm-hmm.
Granted, computer screens are shaped differently now and things like that, and you can play with it in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
I was reading something by from Paul Chadwick, who does Concrete,
mm-hmm.
who actually blew my mind many years ago. He wrote me a real nice little email saying he discovered the inner world and loved it. I'm like, oh my God.
Yeah.
But I'm a book guy.
Mm.
And as much as I like being able to access material online, I like being able to hold it in my hands in the book. And to get too crazy with formatting online, because it's online, you could really damage your ability to put it together in a book.
Mm-hmm.
What Paul Chadwick was talking about, the article I recently read before I segued, was breaking all of his panels that they could be sliced horizontally into thirds. So that if you put those three rows together, boom, there's your page for traditional print media.
Mm-hmm.
I love print media. I love books. So to me, at this point in my career, I'm still to the point where I like producing things that I can distribute online, but then also distribute, then collect into print books without too much of the crazy stuff, and not take away from the experience that you get online, you know?
Okay. There was, talk about corporate comics for a second, the Avengers versus X-Men, they had Avengers versus X-Men Infinite, I guess it was Infinite, not number one or whatever, and I thought that was, the digital experience was one of the best experiences I had with comics last year, and then seeing it printed in the hardcover, I was like, that actually is not bad.
And how did they do that one? What did they
well,
do
the that? It's like the idea behind the digital comic was not to do like guided view, which is, you know, what the comiXology thing is, like it zooms in and zooms out of the page. Right. Like I can't handle that. My brain does not handle that. I'm too old, too whatever. I'm like, this is not work. The digital comic basically, let's see, I don't know how to explain this. It controlled the reveal. So
that's
you would have,
right.
let's say you have three panels sort of in a horizontal tier. Instead of showing, you know, a close up on one, close up on the second, close up on the third, you'd have the first one and then the other two are black, and then the second one, you know, you swipe the page, and then the first two panels are shown. Then you swipe the page, and then it's now all three are shown. And then maybe in the first panel,
controlling the pacing.
Right. So, yeah, it's really about controlling pacing as opposed to controlling your eye. And I thought that I was like, that's a much more interesting way to fit things for, you know, fit things for digital, but then also, but you have to sort of know that going in, right? You can't sort of create the page for print and then say, oh, we'll do that for online. It's like, no, you have to either abandon print or sort of figure out a way to get print from your digital stuff. So I can see that if you're, still interested in keeping print as an option, that you're probably not, excited about. I will say it was handled pretty well. So
that's cool. And the thing, sometimes that stuff can get gimmicky, so you got to be
mm-hmm.
careful. And absolutely, but if you're gonna use the computer, use it to your full advantage.
Yeah.
I mean, with my end goal being having a book in my hand, that's why I do it the way that I do. And fun, man. The more people can explore the stuff, the better. You
right.
know?
Cool. I mean, it probably helped that it was written by Mark Waid. So it was a good, it was a good story. And he was worked with a French artist who's really, it was drawn by Stuart Immonen, but it was sort of brainchilded by this French artist that he's been working with, which has helped him on his thrill bent stuff and sort of the methodology and the planning of, okay, how do we, what effect are we trying to look for and stuff. So it's, you know, it's a different thing than just, I don't know. And then sort of putting your page up online.
And hey, man, and good. If it works, that's awesome. Like I said, just keep pushing. Keep pushing. Figure out what we can do.
So I was, you know, interested. But obviously, you know, putting your page up online and stuff is, I don't want to sound like, oh, you know, you should abandon that and do this other thing. It's just, you know, it's an interesting, that was one I was like, okay, that's got some legs, you know, because Guided View, I'm like, okay, it's digital comics. You move your thing. I was like, that is fucking annoying. Okay, I can't, because I don't know if it's on program, but if you zoom in on something, my brain is telling me you're not getting the full picture, right? You are losing the artist's intent and the artist's, you know, artistry of combining all of these images into one page. It's like watching a widescreen movie on pan and scan. My brain is telling me you're losing something, you're losing something, you're losing something, you know? Whereas in these other digital, you know, in these the Infinite Comics and the Thrill Bent stuff, I was like, I'm not really losing anything. I'm getting something different. It's not better. It's just different.
Right.
So there's the end of my rant.
I agree with you.
Yeah.
And again, we all got to follow our own path. We got to do what we are excited about doing.
You spent some time as a music journalist in your pre-comic youth, I guess.
Yeah. That was my, before I devoted myself to writing about comics, I did music journalism.
Before you found comics, you spent your wayward days as a...
I was a late bloomer on comics. I didn't start reading comics until I was a teenager. I've always been very passionate about music and like writing. I talked about the wrong book. I got into music journalism to kind of keep my hand moving as I was preparing to get into comics.
Okay. I have two words for you, some word association. If I say the name Mike Patton, what is the first thing that pops into your head?
God.
Okay. And why?
He is a real inspiration for me, even though I don't create music myself. At my desk, I have the photograph of the time I met Mike Patton. I landed an interview with him. I actually met him twice, and the second meeting was the interview. He was a guy, people aren't familiar with Mike Patton. He was the lead singer of Faith No More, and then went to Mr. Bungle, Tomahawk, Peeping Tom, I mean, you name it. And he's just a guy that has such a wide swath and just a mind-boggling variety of music. He had Mondo Kanye, which was all covers with a full backing orchestra of Italian pop songs from the 1950s and 60s that he sings in Italian. And then he does an EP with the Dillinger Escape Plan, which is, you know, math metal, you know, screeching, you know, math metal. And then he does Fantomas, which is these weird sound experiment songs. And then he does Peeping Tom, which is like this pop project. And then he does Tomahawk. And he just does this variety of stuff, and it's all really cool. I can't say I like all of it as much as I like, you know, there's different degrees how much I like the different things he does. Mm-hmm. But it just... he puts out whatever the hell he wants to put out, what he feels like putting out, regardless of whether it's going to be successful or not. And he's immensely talented. He is hands down the best living rock vocalist alive today, period. Anyone that says no doesn't get it. And I hate drawing that line in the sand, but there it is. I did. I mean, when you look at the range of vocals this guy has, and he's read something in Rolling Stone recently, like the 100 best male vocalists, and he wasn't even in the list. And I'm like, really? But, you know, the people that were in there were more like the mainstream guys and stuff like that. And I'm like, how do you not include this vocal god in that list? I mean, the amount of stuff he does is just mind-bogglingly good, you know.
See, I only know him through his Faith No More stuff, and I appreciate that. Is when you say vocal range, I mean, is it just more like approach, or even just like physical range, or combination, or
yes?
Okay. Well, yes. Because the singer, just go off on music for a second. The singer that I always feel doesn't quite get the credit that he's due, even though I'm sure he gets a fair amount of credit, is Freddie Mercury.
Oh,
they were like, you know, the top 10, they did like the top 10 voices of the 20th century. And he was on there, but he was on there like under Frank Sinatra or something. Like he was not at like number one. And I was like, okay, I'm sorry, but I got to call bullshit on that.
Yeah.
Freddie
Mercury was awesome. And like with Patton, you can like go to YouTube and look up the top 10 vocal performances of Mike Patton. And they just give you snippets of the range of stuff he's done. And whether it be The Faith No More, Mr. Jungle, or Tomahawk, or Peeping Tom, or Adult Themes for Voice, or Moonchild, or Fantomas, the range of sounds that man can produce is mind-boggling. And the fact that he puts out these records that maybe no one will buy it. Doesn't matter. This is what he wants to do, and he's doing it, you know. A dear friend of mine said about Mike Patton years ago, he's like a live wire thrashing around on the street. And if he could just focus that energy he has towards one or two things, he'd probably be a lot more successful. But again, I define success. He can look at his catalog, and he's doing all this cool stuff. And people that are into music know that he's just an amazing vocalist.
I think looking at your career, reading Right and Wrong, which you mentioned Mike Patton, but certainly I think he's a good role model in that, you know, he's going to do – well, one, he's, like, incredibly talented and whatever. But two, which, you know, some people are and some people not. But even if you're not, the work ethic and just the I'm going to do my own thing, I think is something that, you know, that you took away in your career. And I think people can take away in their careers, you know, that fearlessness of, you know, I've got my voice. I'm going to do – you know, because you can almost look at Faith No More as being sort of like his big two, like his corporate, whatever. Like, I'm going
to
do this.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
Yeah.
He was able to parlay that into doing all this different stuff.
Mm-hmm. Now, has Faith No More, did they regroup? Or at least for like tours or something?
They did. They went on another tour and stuff like that. What they did from there was, I was just reading an interview, I was kind of bummed out, I was hoping they'd do some stuff in the States more. Right. And they said it was fun, but we don't want to get in and just do it for the money again. You know, they said we had fun doing it, and it was neat, but that it just kind of scratched. And I don't know if they're being coy or what, but I take that at face value, you know, when I got to meet Mike Patton and stuff. And there's a picture of me with Mike Patton in the book.
There is? Is that the same picture that you were...
That's the one I'm looking at. Okay. Except my version doesn't have the Photoshop sunglasses. But even the story of how I got to meet him was pretty fun.
Yeah, that's also in the book.
What a trip that was. Yeah. But, you know, you just got to do what, you know, kind of comes full circle in an interview. You got to do what you want to do. You got to tell your stories. You got to do the things that you want to do, the things that are going to make you most happy. And that's really why I idolize Patton so much. He does what he wants to do. He made his Faith No More money. He was able to parlay that into his own record company. He was able to do the things he wants. And he can do just to do what he wants to do, which at the end of the day is the way it should be. You can't go out to create art, whether it be in comics or otherwise, based on chasing money. That's not the name of the game. You can't chase the money. You just got to do what you want to do, believe in your, you know, be passionate about what you do, follow the things that you're most passionate about, and you'll find success because you'll be happy. If I was to fall off the face of the earth tomorrow, I cannot regret anything I've done in comics. What an amazing ride this has been. And for me, again, being able to put out the Right or Wrong book, to be able to help other people get to that point, that's an honor. That is a genuine honor. I tear up sometimes. I mean, legitimately, people will talk to me about how much the book has helped them and stuff. It's like, my God, good, man, good. You know, that makes – I'm glad I can help. And people say, well, aren't you afraid that you're feeding your own competition? No, man.
Yeah.
I'm making some better good comics out there I can read.
Yeah.
You know, so, yeah, just got to do what you're passionate about and love what you're doing and you'll be successful.
By the way, that last question was from our friend Dave. Dave, don't say I don't do anything for you.
I know the feeling. It is the real thing.